Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Chrysler.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 309 for November 6th of 2015. Crossover sale highs to luxury brand lows. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 20 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Thanks for joining us here on Autoline After Hours. We've got an action-packed show, or at least a lot of topics to talk about. Gary Vasilash, how you doing?
Good. Sorry I missed a show last week. I was down in the southeast driving the sixth-generation Camaro.
Oh.
And so, you know, it occurred to me, what was it, 2 weeks ago, we had the Roush Mustang in here, which is based on the 2016 Mustang GT.
Right.
And so here's the sixth-generation Camaro. And I think that those two cars right now are the best they've ever been in terms of the design execution of those vehicles. I think they're just superb. But anyway, right, we got other people here, too.
We
got to
introduce others. Todd Lassa, back by popular demand from Automobile Magazine.
John, always good to be here, and I enjoy it a lot.
Cool. And we got Bob Gritzinger from Ward's.
Hey, happy to be from Ward's and back. And I've not had a chance to do this before. I've been on your other show, but this is great. And great studio. Love the environment.
Welcome aboard. Okay, you guys, so let's get into the news of the week. And we got to start with Volkswagen, I think.
Yeah.
Todd, you were going to say?
I was going to ask John, actually, about the... I'm sorry, Gary, about the new Camaro, because I haven't driven it yet. And several shows back, I mentioned that I had trouble getting used to the design of the new Mustang. I actually thought it wasn't radical enough and a departure from the previous Mustangs. And now I look at this new Camaro, and it makes the Mustang look like a huge departure, like it's really moved it forward. And I just wonder, you know, the Camaro has outsold the Mustang since it returned for the 2010 model year. What do you think now? I mean, people buy those cars for design as much as anything else.
Right. Well, I mean, so saying that you don't think the Camaro, the sixth gen, is sufficiently different from the fifth gen.
Camaro came along, and it hadn't been around for a while.
Right.
And people buying those cars, and I read a lot of stories about people, trading in Honda Civics or Toyota Corollas for them because, you know, they wanted something flashier. And, you know, they buy it for the design, and the Camaro came along, and it was something new. And now the Mustang comes along, and the new Mustang looks a little... There's enough of cues from the old Mustang to make you think, yeah, you know, this is a Mustang.
Right.
But now, compared
to a modern 21st century Mustang,
yes,
it doesn't
it's
look
a
like
far
a 64 throwback.
Design, whereas I think they went way too conservative on the Camaro.
See, that was my original thought until when you see a 15 and a 16 side by side, and you mm-hmm. begin to look at, I mean, the sheet metal, I think, on the 16 is just formed with a crispness that is completely
missing
absent
from the
you know, because you know, look at the previous one, and it just sort of, it almost seems like a bathtub to me compared to the new one. Mm-hmm. Now, it still is identifiably
Camaro.
You know, a Camaro, but I mean, what really surprised me while I was driving, you know, down I-95 or wherever the hell I was, that how many people knew that I was in the new one? You know, that they, you know, they come by and they'd be waving or thumbs up and things like
or
that.
Or they just don't see Camaros down there at 95, wherever you were.
But I mean, there was a
BMW
surprising thing.
I was
rolling around, and it surprised me how many Camaros I did see. I was driving in Savannah, downtown Savannah, which is the last place you really want to drive a Camaro. And, you know, even a 16 Camaro, because, I mean, you're so low and the windows are like gun slots and you're sort of like peering out, and here you are in this, you know, congested Savannah. But I really think that they did what they needed to do with this car. I think that it's again, just if you look at the way they handled the tail lights, the new front fascia, the lights in the front.
I think the
body
front end
work,
they nailed it. I still don't like the tail lights. I haven't liked the tail lights on the Camaro for a couple of generations now.
Well, and Ford really has a winner with its having brought back the sequential turn signals, which weren't on the Mustang until 2010, but of course Thunderbird and Mercury Cougar beforehand.
In days of yore.
In days of yore. Are you willing to pick one over the other between Mustang and Camaro?
I like the Mustang better.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. Huh? I can't wait to drive the Camaro.
Yeah.
Back to VW, right?
Back to VW.
VW. Yeah.
That was a good diversion, yeah. So, yeah. Todd, I was going to start with you, so I'll start with you. What do you make of this? It's like every time you turn around, it's like another shoe's dropping.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, you know, I looked very closely. Everybody was waiting to see what the October sales numbers would be for Volkswagen. They were up 0.0. Well,
not according to Ward's data. No. If you go on a daily selling rate basis. Yeah.
They were down.
They were down 3% or something, which is actually still not that bad.
Well, and remember, you have to look at, I mean, this comes from the fact that they sold no diesels in October. Right. And they just froze the diesels on the lots.
Right.
And if you look at the numbers, the VW Passat, which... after it launched, was selling at the rate of 10, even 11,000 per month for a while, and then settled down to roughly 8,000, 9,000. That car was up slightly. They used to claim a take rate of about 25% diesel on that car, and I'm sure that settled down a little bit as they were competing more, maybe a little bit more directly with Toyota Camry and Honda Accord. Although I think they never quite got where they wanted to be regarding that. And then the Jetta sales were down quite a bit. And then you look at, and Volkswagen does a nice thing of breaking out the Golf sales, including GTI. And, of course, both the GTI and obviously the e-Golf are not diesels. And those numbers were up somewhat, and the standard Golf number was down. I think maybe the fallout to the consumer might be similar to what happened with General Motors on the ignition lock, and similar to Toyota with the unintended acceleration. At least that's the way the yearly returns look, although I've also read that we're looking at this month as being a much bigger indicator of how much it might hurt Volkswagen.
Well, and then it's expanding now to Porsche models and...
I told Porsche they should have never gone outside the sports car box.
But into what? The V6?
Well, the
3-liter diesel now, as the EPA has said that they found it. And, of course, Volkswagen said, 9. This is not
what do you make of that, Gary?
Right. Well, I mean, what did they say? What did they say the first time when they were presented with that information about the diesel?
Well, what have they said for years when they asked them?
No, it was not there. And then slowly. So do you honestly think... So the EPA scored a big victory with the first one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they'd be willing to squander that victory by claiming that there was a software defeat device put in these larger engines if they didn't find one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's highly unlikely.
And the strange thing, too, is that if you look back at just the four-cylinder issue or problem, that, that Volkswagen installed that software and admitted it has, in both the urea-treated diesels, four-cylinder diesels, right, and the non-urea-treated four-cylinder diesel. Why do they feel they needed to do this across the board, apparently, or allegedly, I guess we should say at this point, since they're still denying the V6, right?
Right.
Yeah, but that's what I don't get.
Yeah, why wouldn't they just come forward and say, okay, we've been caught here, and here are the other engines that you might want to... That need to be part of this. Let's just get it all out there and clear it all out at once.
Or is it that they're talking to their own people, going, okay, who cheated? What did you cheat on? And they went, no, we didn't do anything on the 3-liter. It's still trying to cover their tracks.
Right.
So Volkswagen then says, no, we didn't cheat on the 3-liter. Mm-hmm. But EPA was very specific as to how they found this and what the thing does. This is not like we think it's doing it. No, they were hyper-specific as to how it was cheating.
It wasn't just based on emission testing. It was based on knowing what was going on, how it was affecting.
Yeah, well, what they were saying is, and I don't have it verbatim in front of me, but they said exactly 1 second after the test procedure ends, the thing goes into, blow it out, with full pollution mode.
Right.
Well, then they have the problem with the gasoline engines, with the cam lobe maybe falling off the vehicle, which is not a good thing for your engines. And
we also saw, you know, there's a second shoe that's dropped, right? Now Volkswagen's come out and said, oh, by the way, there's about 800,000 vehicles that don't meet CO2 standards. And it was very interesting how they said they're still covering their tracks. You know, for number one, they say, oh, we've discovered some unexpected irregularities. I mean, to me, that's just pure lawyer talk. And then they said later, and you had to like dig this out, it said, oh, and this involved mostly diesels. Oh, hello. That means it involves gasoline engines, too.
Yeah, sure. Right.
And I think we're going to find out these guys had this stuff up and down their model range in terms of engines.
And in terms of how, and knowing that, you know, it worked here. Why not? And it's the whole culture of trying to meet what the big fella on top wants. And he's bearing down and saying, we have to meet these standards. We have to meet these standards.
So you're talking Ferdinand Piëch.
I mean, you're talking Piëch and not Winterkorn.
And,
you know.
And Winterkorn. I just attended this green kind of conference in Venice, Italy, where they were talking about sustainability, and the Volkswagen emissions scandal had just dropped when I was there. Hot topic. And they, you know, for them, for the green people, this is like everybody does this. These guys got caught, but, what, you know, and they went through a litany of different emissions violations over the years, whether it was General Motors or these guys or these guys. And
well, we've
this
often
is just the latest one. And there are far more that we're not even aware of.
Well, we've often criticized Ford EcoBoost engines in which they've invested a lot for either having Eco or Boost, but not to the same time, and therefore not getting real-world fuel economy that meets the EPA numbers. And so I was wondering, I was going to ask about the thing around the periphery of this whole story is that the third shoe to drop, if I could tangle up a cliche, is
there may be a centipede involved here.
Yeah,
we may have lots of dropping.
Yeah. Is Philippine. Oh, everybody's expecting that some other manufacturers are going to get hit first by the diesel scandal. You know, there's been some talk. Oh, you know, is the EPA also looking at
this company or this that? Company. Or
but they're testing them, and they have tested thing. Others, yep. and nothing's come out
nothing's
yet.
Nothing's come out yet. Yeah. So but this kind of gets back into, you know, we were talking a little bit before the show about the Chinese thing, and we're talking about coal, and yet another study that says that a Tesla isn't as clean in Michigan, where you charge it up using a coal-fired power plant on the other end of the cord, versus California, where it's almost all natural gas. You know, so the auto. So wherever you are on the whole issue of global warming, is that at least cars are not contributing what they used to, and because of all of these standards, and now, and there's a lot of focus on coal-fired power plants, on what China does, on other, you know, another study I heard years ago was that some laptops can cause more pollution than a Hummer, and that was from 2004, 2005, a British study. So, you know,
it's a big laptop.
Yeah. It's a big laptop, but
a coal-powered laptop,
not a plane, whatever that is, you can't take
probably,
that.
Probably, well, and airplanes
you
especially
couldn't carry it on the plane.
Airplanes would be another example, and so that at least the automotive business was, you know, kind of going in the right direction from a green perspective.
Yeah,
and so for something like this. And then you have the green community saying, oh, this happens a lot anyway. But
yeah, we just haven't discovered it.
The scope of the Volkswagen scandal, you know, just kind of blows that up, I think.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and just as an aside, all this green conference was going on in Venice, where they'd like to point out you don't see any cars. I point out, you see a lot of boats, and they're spewing all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's it depends on, you know, choose your poison.
They don't use those long sticks for the gondolas.
Well, they do, but those are in the little canals.
Taxis,
right.
Yeah. The vaporettos are...
Any way to get around at any kind of rate of speed is... Yeah,
but to be fair, I mean, so you know, we have lots of automobile manufacturers that are living up to what they've signed up for, right? I mean, that they're following
the emissions, right.
They're following the rules, whether they like the rules or don't like the rules, whether the rules are sensible, the rules are crazy, they're doing it.
Right.
And then here we have a case of a company that was basically, you know, talking all about clean diesel, was, you know, promoting what a wonderful thing this is and their Think Blue program and on and on and on and on. And then lo and behold, they weren't playing the same game that General Motors and Mercedes and yeah, everybody else was.
They all had the rules
and they all played. These guys didn't.
But there's kind of a two different levels here. There's what Volkswagen has already admitted to regarding four-cylinder diesels, but there's also gaming. There's that, you know, most car companies test their own, and they lump together, for example, a full-size pickup truck. If you look at the variations at the EPA website, they're not nearly as wide as they are for the entire variety of cab designs and engines and the combos of all of those, how many combos they have. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a fair amount of latitude in the system, I think.
Well, are people going to go to jail?
Prison, my wife would say.
Yes, prison. Yes.
Prison, not jail.
Yeah,
jail would be, yeah.
Jail's like a misdemeanor.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that distinction.
What do they call them in Germany?
Prison.
No, jail is where you might be held when you're first charged.
Exactly.
Whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony.
Up to 90 days.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Are they going
to prison? Will they be incarcerated?
Yeah. Somebody, somewhere, you know, it's kind of like, you know, that Nicolas Cage movie. Somebody has to go to prison.
Yeah, I think perhaps, but on the other hand, that issue was raised for the GM ignition switch problem.
Different.
We're probably tougher in the U.S. than in Europe on these things.
Yeah.
My question now is, where's Ferdinand Piak? Is he on a private island someplace or what?
Far away, yes.
Far away.
And as much as he fought to keep that job, now he's
laughing
going,
one or
whoa,
another part
dog,
of the body off.
The angels are on my side,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, enough of Volkswagen. I'm sure in weeks to come we're still going to be talking about it.
More.
I think there's more shoes to drop. Hey, Hyundai announced this week, out of the blue, I didn't know that this was coming. I don't know if you guys did. They're launching, finally, their luxury brand, Genesis.
This was a surprise in that they just, nobody knew it was coming, and yet we know that it's an old lore that when they launched the Genesis as a car, the sedan and the coupe, that there was some talk that they may do a separate luxury channel, a la Toyota's Lexus or Nissan's Infiniti. And they were apparently talked out of that. The rumor is that it happened, that the U.S., you know, kind of pushed back and said, no. And
we're not ready.
Not only that, but remember, this happened. The car launched in late 2008. That would be a great time to launch a new brand, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So they probably saved Hyundai's bacon on that thing. But I've been there. I've been to South Korea several times on some Hyundai and some Kia programs. In fact, I'm going on a Kia program next week. And it was pretty clear to me 10, 15 years ago how Hyundai always had luxury aspirations, that they didn't want to be known forever as being the builder of the Pony or the Elantra.
Right. Well, and they're following lockstep with the Japanese model. And you build your following with quality and inexpensive consumer, bread and butter cars, and then you add your next layer, because hopefully those people want to stay with you, just like with Honda or with Toyota. They want to stay with you, but they'd like a little something nicer.
But they've had those cars. I mean, so they've had the Equus, and they've had, you know, now we're on the second generation Genesis.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So back in the day, with John Krafcek, whom we've not talked about with his new job now, but at some point we will.
Yeah.
When I would talk to him back in the day about, okay, what are you guys doing with this Genesis thing, and why is there not another channel?
Yeah.
Because remember, they also had the Veracruz, the crossover utility that was, you know, that they were comparing against, you know, RXs and whatnot.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that they compared it to those,
And so I said, come on, John, you know, why are you guys selling these cars? And remember when the Genesis first came out, that suddenly the price point went from, you know, like Sonata here to Genesis here, you know, just a big delta between the two prices. And it's just like, okay, why don't you have this channel? He goes, it's non-economical at this point in order to do that. And we, you know, and we don't want to.
And that's a great point. It is very economical now because, you know, since the Great Recession, the luxury car, the premium car segments have been growing at a faster pace than the commodity segments. And as we all pretty much know, there's no margin in commodity cars anymore. Or if there ever was, it's razor thin right now. And you know, you publish on your daily show when Mercedes and Ford and General Motors list their quarterly earnings pretty much on the same day, and that Mercedes builds far fewer cars than General Motors, but their gross revenues are the same. So you can see why, you know, Mercedes is doing all these sub models and getting in every little segment, and so is BMW. And so it just makes perfect sense that that what I guess will be called the Genesis brand will do the same.
See, what surprised me was that they announced that they will have 6 vehicles by 2020.
Yeah.
So I'm like counting on my fingers. I'm like, okay, they have Equus, that's one. They have Genesis Sedan, that's two. They have Genesis Coupe, that's three.
Which will be a different Genesis Coupe if they want to be luxury, because that car is not luxury.
No, that's it. I mean, it's a boy racer car. But I'm thinking, okay, so what is it? So I contacted them and I asked them. I said, you know, so what's the deal? And so there will be a large luxury sedan called the G90. Very clever using that G, huh?
Yeah.
A mid-luxury sedan, the G80.
Okay.
4 new products: luxury compact sedan in 2017, luxury midsize utility vehicle, and luxury sports coupe in a luxury sport utility vehicle.
And the luxury compact sedan would be a direct competitor for the BMW 3 Series, which sells in huge numbers in the U.S. and in Western Europe.
So basically what they probably did was they took the spreadsheet out and said, okay, we need one of these, we need one of these.
But why not?
They're all going to be rear-wheel drive.
I didn't hear luxury CUV in there.
Yeah.
Did you?
Oh, sure, that's...
That was the last one.
Okay, all right, because... That seems to be where everybody is.
Yeah.
That's where the money is.
And you'd want to do, and maybe not right away in 2020, but you'd want to have 2 or 3 or 4 of those coming along the way the luxury market is going these days. But remember, the other thing, too, is that unlike, say, Acura versus Honda or now Lincoln versus Ford, these will be on exclusive rear-wheel drive platforms, which presumably won't be shared with Hyundai. And I round back to that thing I've mentioned many times when Hyundai finally gave Kia the Genesis platform for the K900.
Yeah.
Kia called that the Prestige Prestige proportion, the rear-wheel drive dashed axle, and they realized that that's part of the look of the car, and that's what helps make it premium or luxury.
That's right. Hey, look, we got to take a quick break here right now. We got to take a commercial break. We want to give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. And when we come back from this break, Dr. Data will be in the house with a new number.
Hey.
Hey.
Did you have a good nap?
The Firestone Destination LE2. Tough enough to handle anything the road throws at you.
Oops.
And you throw at it. Durable, dependable Firestone tires. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay, we're back, and as promised, Dr. Data's in the house with a number for us all to ponder.
All right, so usually I come up with these very complex, difficult numbers that are hard to wrap one's mind around. So this week we're going to do something slightly different. So Carmen, could you bring up today's number?
Zero.
Zero is the number of accidents that Google reported to the DMV in California regarding their autonomous vehicles. So they've had no accidents in the month of October. Now, realize that they've actually got 48 cars rolling around out there. And so they have 23 Lexus RX 450Hs, which we can see behind there. They have their prototype cars as well. They have 25 of those. And again, we had Roush on the show, and Roush built those prototype cars.
The little bubble cars.
The little bubble cars. So they've got those too. And so according to Google, their cars are combined doing 10,000 to 15,000 miles per week. So I think that when they have absolutely zero accidents, that's pretty astonishing.
Considering they're, you know, doing that Google mapping thing at the same time. No, I'm kidding.
Well, and, you know, they've reported accidents in the past. They started reporting that earlier this year.
Right.
And obviously they're doing all that mileage to get to the point where they can claim zero accidents. It's if you talk to Chris Urmson or now, I guess, John Krafcik, you find that, you know, that's all part of the process to make it as close to perfect as possible. And, you know, the accidents they reported were mostly them getting rear-ended.
Well, hold on, because I think Dr. Data...
Well, it's sort of amusing that there was actually a... so if you go to the DMV in California, you can actually get their accident reports. Okay. So this is a real live accident report that includes one of the RX 450Hs, and I found it very amusing that where we see the other party's information, they were rear-ended by a Tesla Model S. So that leads into another thing. You know, this whole thing about autonomy. We've talked about this on the show quite a bit, and I hadn't realized, and maybe you guys were aware of this, but so again, going back to a show, remember we had Corey Wells on the show who did the documentary on the 31 hours, 7 minutes of the...
Driving across America. As fast as possible.
As fast as possible. And what I didn't realize was that recently Alex Roy, who was the guy who was driving the car that Corey made the documentary about, that he recently did a run with two other people, Carl Reese and Dina Mastrucci, in a Tesla Model S, and they went across the United States. Now, the run that they had made in the documentary was from California to L.A. Well,
No, I'm sorry,
it was in New York to L.A., sorry.
Yeah.
And so these guys figured this thing out that it would have the wind behind you to make it better. They did, in a Tesla, 57 hours and 48 minutes across the country, less than 12 hours spent charging, okay? Hmm. And here's the astonishing part. According to Alex Roy, 96% of the time was on the Tesla autopilot, autonomous driving.
Stop me if you've heard this from me before, but I've always wanted to write a screenplay to revive the Weekend at Bernie's series and have Bernie behind the wheel of an autonomous car going coast to coast.
Perfect. Yeah.
But that means
call me Hollywood.
Yeah. That means that this Tesla was in autopilot mode at quite high speeds.
Right. Well, they average
terminal velocity.
They averaged 65 miles an hour across the country.
That includes all your stops for charging, including the charging stops.
Average speed across the thing, and it was interesting. So Alex Roy was just like complete. You know, he was just completely supportive of the autopilot. I mean, and he just basically said, okay, let's face it. This is not like autopilot 1.0. It's really 0.9. Yeah. You know what I mean? It isn't fully baked yet.
Well, and it helps that you have a good driver, an excellent driver like that, who understands exactly how that works. Because you remember the first week that the Teslas were flashed with that software that allowed that, you had several idiots taking selfies.
Yeah,
right.
And plenty of YouTube getting videos.
So, and in fact, this also kind of folds into the Tesla Q3 earnings call, which I listened most of it. And, you know, it's hard to take the sycophantic analysts, because it's all analysts asking the questions. Elon Musk does not take questions from the press during this call. And one analyst actually asked the question, Do you have any stats on how many accidents that the Tesla autonomous system prevented?
Well, we'll just look that up, right?
How can you tell which one you prevented?
I mean, pick a number.
Yeah. I hope they kept this guy out of the car, you know, that's for sure.
Well, or if they put him in it, they just let him go, you know, full autonomy.
Yeah, well, Toons is the cat driving, perhaps.
Yeah, Uber.
But I think the other thing, too, and we've talked about it on the show, is even though the Google cars are not getting in accidents, they're getting hit a lot. Mm. And I think it's got to do with the way they drive.
Yeah.
They don't drive like people. Mm. They actually obey the law.
Not only that, but they hit the brakes hard.
I
had a ride in one, and I wrote about it in the August issue of Automobile. And the it brakes way harder than you would want from, say, a chauffeur or an Uber driver. And one of the techs explained that, well, they're being overly cautious. This happened, for example, if a bike pulls out in the lane or another car pulls out from the parking lane into your lane, the system wants to be overly cautious rather than not cautious enough.
Well, I think we see that in just the semi-autonomous stuff that we're driving regularly now.
Just the warning lights.
They're much, and those that you know, an active cruise control system where it's can be very aggressive in slowing down when a car changes lanes in front of you, things like that.
Right. But also, if you have,
it's interesting in this accident that the Google car had, and you read the accident details, and what ended up happening was that, as you say, as a Google vehicle approached the intersection of Shoreline Boulevard and High School Way, a pedestrian began to cross the northbound lanes of Shoreline Boulevard. The Google AV slowed to yield as it approached the crosswalk, but then, and this is very clever, out of abundance of caution, the test driver took over. And it was another car that then slammed into him. So this was actually being driven by a human being when it got into an accident. So is it the Google car's fault for doing something?
Or the human intervention.
Well, this all gets back to the difference between Google and the automakers. When you go on one of their autonomous programs, they always talk about the driver always either being in control or taking back control at some point. And Google, the philosophy at Google is that eventually that won't be necessary.
They're going to blow past that.
That's why
the automakers are still trying to work with what they got, and Google's like, we don't got any of that. We're going right to the ultimate vision. Yeah. We're going full autonomy.
Yeah, right. Trying to solve it.
You know, and I was, I kept thinking, because there's this abiding argument about, okay, so who is responsible or who's in control, and is it better for a human being than the robot car, and on and on and on, So I've been thinking about this a lot, because there's always this worst case scenario. Okay, if the car is driving along and there's a group of nuns, does the car run it over? Does it swerve and hit a tree and the driver? So we come up with all of these ethical dilemmas, but I was looking. According to the CDC, in 2013, 10,076 people were killed in alcohol impaired driving crashes. Okay, so one third of all deaths are people drunk behind the wheel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what would we rather have, a robot car or a bunch of drunks?
And you also have systems now. And
a robot car driving all those drunks, that solves it.
That's the whole point. Right. So if you have a drunk guy, so conceivably, that solves
probably
that.
Probably going to do better. Yes.
Probably,
The goal is...
Even if it stops aggressively.
Yeah.
The goal for these systems, whether it's from the automaker or from Google, is that it won't get into that situation, that it'll read far enough ahead. And I know what you're talking about. Maybe a bunch of nuns quickly cross the street on one side and a kid with a ball or a dog or whatever starts to cross on the other side. Which way do you go? But presumably the Google car being that extra cautious, especially if it's in school zone where the speed limit's 15, will slow down to 15 and be very easy, or let's say easier, to avoid having to make that decision because you just brake in time.
Well, they'll have to make a decision. And, look, I've said all along, of course autonomous cars are going to kill people. They're just not going to kill nearly as many.
Right, yeah.
We have the opportunity here in the next couple of decades of eliminating just in the U.S. alone, 30,000 fatalities, and prevent 2 million people plus from going to the hospital every single year. That's just the U.S. figures. You know, you take that out on a global basis, you're talking significant numbers.
Right.
That said, there's always the question of how far along, how old will we be when it comes to the point where, as Musk has said, you know, autonomous cars will take over and operator-driven cars will become will go the way of the horse. When if it comes to that point, while I'm still alive, I'm happy that the vast majority of people will be driving that way. I have no interest in it. I think at that point I would hope that I could still use a bicycle in public transportation.
It seems like it's going to be a long ways out before you can't shut it off and drive the vehicle yourself.
You know, it depends. As our old
maybe there are limitations. You know, maybe it's you have to be still properly licensed, and you have to be sober, and you have to have your capacities, that kind of thing.
As Jim Hall, the man who knows too much, once said, you know, it's going to happen slowly, but once you have a breakthrough, it's going to happen quickly.
Right.
Wow. It'll change the
way you're right. So if you had asked people in 1910, is the automobile going to replace the horse? Most of them would have said no. No, of course, cars are becoming more common, but in my lifetime, but no. And certainly by 1930, the switch had happened completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
Largely because of the Ford Model T.
And largely because of that. But I think it's entirely possible we'll see the same sort of thing. So in 2015, we go, well, is it going to happen in our lifetime? 20 years later, 2035, I'll bet the switch has happened.
Look at everyone. You know, Volvo's still holding on to the 2020.
Yep.
If you're in a Volvo, you will not. There will be no fatalities or serious injuries in our vehicles. And they're not the only one that is trying to adapt that as an approach. I think General Motors is saying the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And Volvo has said it will take responsibility if the car is in autonomous mode and is in an accident. And the Volvo is is responsible for the accident.
Right.
On the other hand, there was a study a year or two ago that found that certain brands are almost already there, and Volvo is one of them,
in Mercedes.
U.S. statistics. Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the exact opposite end of autonomous driving.
SEMA
show.
Gary, what do you think?
I mean, this gets back to this whole thing of, you know, that we're sort of, you know, talking about that, you know, you have a show like that, and that's a show where you see Copo Camaros, And you see
Tundra Zines.
Well,
we got to talk about that in a second.
Think about this. While Todd is all concerned that he may be still in having all of his faculties yet be forced to be in some sort of robot car that he doesn't want any part of, you still have a giant trade show. You know, this the Specialty Equipment Manufacturers Association trade show that has nothing but hot performance cars or great exaggerated things like the
Tundra.
I can't even say that.
Yeah.
And I mean, so
you're right. But on the other hand, if Musk is right, if Jim Hall is right, in X number of years, which might be either side of 2030, for example, we might still be buying those cars, but only to take them to a private country club racetrack, or maybe on very limited roads, which may be fine, might be enough. In which case, yes, I'll still have a car, and yes, I'll use a bicycle or public transportation otherwise.
I mean, track cars are just that. They're for the track.
Yeah.
And, you know, a Copo Camaro is for the track.
Right.
And so I don't think track cars will ever go away.
No.
But you can see, but, you know,
just as racehorses haven't gone away.
But there are a lot of cars there. I mean, and another guy that we had on the show, Pietro Goliar of Mopar. And Mopar had a whole lineup of vehicles, you know, whether they dished up a Dart, and they had a Challenger, and they had a 300, and you just see those things, and these guys are just basically saying, you know what, we're going to make these things look and sound and perform badass, and we don't care.
Let's find the limit.
And there's
and
no apologies.
The one aspect of that, though, I think we need to touch on is that it kind of gets back to what I said about luxury cars versus commodity cars and the margins versus each and how luxury cars are growing at a faster pace than commodity cars. Assuming that, you know, SEMA will be turning out cars like this and people will be buying them, they'll be paying, you know, far more for one of those Camaros than they would a current Camaro, a street Camaro. Yeah. And so is a greater autonomy also going to
SEMA's coincide?
No, wait a minute. Will it coincide with cars becoming a luxury again? In other words, will luxury car owners continue to own luxury cars, and will the great vast majority of people who basically don't care about driving, but maybe they like cars, but will they instead be calling upon an Uber, Google mobile to get from A to B?
Yeah, the vast majority of people will gravitate to mobility in whatever form that is, and that might be a train, a bus, a car that comes to your door and picks you up, your bicycle that gets you to the car that you check out and drive somewhere else, planes, trains, automobiles, but all mobility, and you buy mobility on a card.
Right.
Exactly. And I agree totally.
Yeah.
And then the third aspect of that is that autonomy is also kind of being folded in with full electric cars. Musk has said that. Carlos Ghosn mentioned that at Tokyo last week when they showed the concept, which I forgot what it's called.
IDS.
IDS.
Yeah.
Okay, and it...
good-looking car.
It's supposed to maybe give a hint to the next Nissan Leaf. Mm-hmm. And that car has a... now, of course, it's a concept car, but the steering wheel, when you set it for full autonomy, the steering wheel flips into the dash and then a tablet comes out.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, look, they're trying to dream up where it's all going to go. But think about it this way, and this is why I think SEMA is going to fully embrace autonomous cars, in that you can do whatever you want with the interior now. The seats don't have to face forward. You don't get the steering wheel in the way. Throw out the pedals, the gear shift.
Well, they've been already doing that at SEMA for years.
Exactly right.
You have more room for speakers.
Hey, you go, this is a wonderful convertible Chrysler 300, first one we've seen. Tell us about it. Well, we just cut the top off. We needed space for the speaker.
Yeah, last SEMA I went to, which was either 01 or 02 or something like that, I was counting TV screens in the back of SUVs, and I counted up to 10 in one case. Yeah.
Oh, okay, so here's the Tundrazine.
Oh,
Armin's got the picture up right now. So just so anybody listening to the podcast, it is a Toyota Tundra pickup truck with four doors on each side. I mean, this goes back to the Chucker Cab airport vehicles of decades ago. But if you're
that goes back to the the MTV 80s when there was the giant limousines with bathtubs and
does it have a hot tub in the
crawl mode like the new Tacoma though? Yeah. Can it walk itself out of a sand pit?
This may be an example of the Chinese being copied, because at the Shanghai show 2006 or 7, whatever it was, I saw Toyota 4Runner knockoff that had four doors on each side, and it was made into a limo, and it didn't look like anything I'd want to get into. And by the way, it was powered by a four-cylinder engine with a manual transmission. Mm-hmm. So,
jeez,
I saw that thing, and I thought, oh, and Phil Collins announced last week that he's going to go back on tour again. So, like, perfect, he can drive in that thing.
Hey, look, we got more to talk about, but we've got to take another quick commercial break here. We've got to give another shout-out to one of our great sponsors here. We want to thank Chrysler for sponsoring this show.
There is no royal blood in this country. Nothing is reserved for anyone. It's all just out there, waiting for someone to reach out and take it. And the ones who do, these are the kings and queens of America.
Okay, we're back. And I don't want to give up SEMA just yet because I want to get your guys' reactions to one other car there that I found so interesting, and that was the convertible version of the Optima. Gary, are they just having fun, or are they testing the
No, I think they're having fun because Kia had a whole theme of road trip cars, and that was the A1A, you know, Miami, because it, you know, it's got that turquoise color for it, and I just think they're throwing it out there. The thing that surprises me, though, is if you look at the other cars that Kia showed there, that...
And here's a picture of it up here.
Yeah, that's the...
suicide rear doors.
Right.
Right. I would have thought they would have saved that for April Fool's. No, I mean that as a compliment. I think it's got that sort of wackiness over the top sort of look to it.
It's got a Geneva show. Could work for that.
It looks like, yeah. Yes.
So. But, you know, they've been showing these Tracksters and Mudsters and all these sorts of things. Yeah. And it surprises me that they don't have on offer something that is more of a Jeep competitor. I mean, a real Jeep competitor rather than you know, a Sorento or something that would have some real guts
like
to it.
Because like a Return to the Tracker kind of thing.
Suzuki tried that decades ago. The Jeep thing is just hard to copy with, you know.
Yeah.
And think about it. I mean, Hummer had the 7-slot grill. They didn't stick around for very long. I don't think that would work.
I've heard rumors that GM may be looking at reviving Hummer. I mean, everyone's looking at Jeep going, what are we letting them get away with this for? They've got this to themselves. Their sales are, and we got to talk sales too.
Right.
Their sales are through the roof.
Yes.
And everyone's just sitting back and watching them. I can't believe, you know, a GM, a Ford, a Toyota, others aren't going, God damn it, we're not going to let them just have this segment to themselves.
As long as GM doesn't launch a separate division again. From the get-go, the Hummer should have been a subdivision, just like LaSalle was to Cadillac many years before. Should have been a
sub-brand to
sub-brand
GMC.
To GMC,
GMC, that would have worked for sure.
Wasn't there always the argument that GMC should just be the professional grade of Chevy?
Well, there's
it is, but at least they're selling in numbers that they can legitimately keep it alive. I mean, as they point out, it's the second best-selling brand in the U.S. for them.
Well, speaking of sales, what do you guys make of these latest U.S. sales numbers for October? Holy moly, this market's red hot.
Giant.
But there are like things that I completely don't understand. Maybe you guys can help me out with this. Okay, so for example, the aforementioned General Motors. Okay, Cruise sales were down 35% for October, and Malibu sales were up 122%. Well, what's going on there?
Watching new versions of both.
I want to hear about
I'm going to guess incentives.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess incentives and fleet, even though they say they're walking away from a lot of fleet. I'm guessing a lot of those Malibus are going to Avis and Hertz.
So here's another thing. So we have said many times on the show gas prices are low and people are now buying SUVs and crossovers and they're buying large SUVs. Suburban sales are down 22%. And Tahoe sales are down 16%.
What about Escalade?
Okay, Escalade is the only thing basically that's saving Cadillac's bacon.
Yeah.
Okay, so
SRX sales were also
This is another. Right. So we had Escalade sales, and this is just October versus October. But let's just look for calendar year to date. Escalade sales, October, 32.2%. Escalade ESV, the big long one, up 74.4% for the year. It's 11.4 versus 36.5 for the ESV. Okay, here's the thing that's crazy. SRX sales, they sold in October 6,020 SRXs, which was up 65.4, right? Again, something that's old. Everybody's saying it's got to be replaced. It will be replaced. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let's just take a look at that number, that 6,020, If you take the sales of the ATS, the CTS, and the XTS, you come up with 6,138 cars. So,
Well, that's what people are buying, not the big SUVs. I mean, all those GM models were brand new a year ago.
Right.
The SRX alone is selling more than their cars almost.
Yeah. I know. No, it's a real puzzle.
And it's an old car. And who among us doesn't think the ATS and the CTS are worthy vehicles?
Oh, they're very worthy vehicles.
Oh, absolutely.
But
what's going on?
Well, but that's us. Yep. You're not showing up at a dealership with, you know, three kids you have to load in the back. And
on the commodity side, the Honda CR-V is outselling Civic these days, and the Nissan Rogue was the Rogue was the best-selling Nissan last month. Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, Altima sales are way down, and they're getting ready to do a
new one just about to come out.
But still, I mean, the Rogue is becoming the bestseller. That's the segment to watch, not the big SUVs. Those numbers are relatively small anyhow, so when you have a huge percentage shift in Escalade or Escalade ESV, you're talking going from, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 is, you know, a 50% gain.
Yeah.
And and again, those were brand new a year ago, so they had that first year bump, I think.
Right. But again, but then that brings me back to the Suburban and the Tahoe.
Yeah.
Why are they not?
You know, when I hear the numbers, did Johan Dennison go and pound on the desk and say, God damn it, the only thing I can sell right now are Escalades. I need more production allocated. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Suburban. Sorry, Chevrolet. Yeah. You're doing just fine with a bunch of other stuff. My dealers are going to hang me if I don't get them product. And what's selling right now are Escalades, so give me more of that volume.
Maybe the Secret Service bought a bunch of Suburbans a year ago.
I mean, that was,
yeah.
But, okay, but Yukon and Yukon XL sales are up.
Okay, but what are the numbers?
So Yukon, 3,500. Yukon XL, 2,700.
Yeah, see, it's not a big number, but
yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, but none of them are really big numbers. I mean, the number for Escalade is 18, and the number for Escalade ESV is 13. I mean,
so when you
this is 100, not 1,000, by the way.
And
for,
when you do have some
watching at home
built in, because and I think even GM on one of its sales calls a couple of years ago got into this, the way fleet sales are distributed, they pick a certain month, so you'll see some big blips for upward and downward for cars that
for certain models
on certain months.
Yeah,
I'm guessing there's a little bit of that there.
I mean, and overall,
not in the Cadillac, the Chevy.
The big sport utilities are up 11%, but the crossovers, the smaller ones, 32%.
Yeah.
Just screaming hot.
Midsize sedan buyers are now buying compact SUVs.
Yeah,
exactly.
And this is a global thing, too. Yeah. Now, this isn't just in the U.S. market. Mm-hmm. This is everywhere in the world. People are going to crossovers.
Right.
All
right.
Because you get the same mod room, only you're sitting more up, you're sitting higher, and the driver gets to see more,
which is what they love. They price these things higher.
Exactly.
I just test drove a Mazda CX-3. By and large, decent vehicle. I was stunned when I looked at the sticker price. That stupid thing was nearly $30,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was like, you got to be kidding. You've got to be 30 grand for that?
Yeah, that's a B-segment.
That must have been the McElroy special, though, because I just drove a CX-5 that was 28. And I thought this nicely equipped for 28.
Well, so, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe we got to compare those stickers because I'm telling you, this was $29,830
for the smaller one.
Well, for the smaller one.
Because that's what everybody's really going to, and that's why they're all driving.
Yeah, you look at the Buick numbers, they're doing well with the Encore.
Yeah.
I think that was the only model that they had a plus sign ahead of last month.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So.
Up 38.8%, sold 6,633 of them.
Best-selling Buick in several months on and off.
The Enclave,
at least in the U.S.
Enclave was down.
Yeah.
Okay, look.
Prius was up.
Yeah, well, they got to blow them out before the new one hits the showroom floor, and they got a lot to blow out. But, hey, we got some questions coming in here from the audience. Let's see if you guys can answer some of these questions. So Jonathan wants to know, we were talking about autonomous cars. What about insurance rates? Are they going to be cheaper for autonomous cars? What do you guys think?
I bet they'd be cheaper.
I bet the insurance companies figure out a good end run around this whole thing, and we'll be paying at least as much, if not more.
The question is, who's going to insure it? Is it the car company that provides it or the individual who owns it? To me, and so if it's the car company, you can bet it's going to be a... This
is going to be like Obamacare. It'll change everything in the insurance, but the insurance companies will figure out a way to
make their
even things out.
I think there's going to be two types of insurance that you, the owner of the autonomous car, will buy. So when the big storm comes and knocks the tree over in your yard and smashes into your autonomous car, you're still covered.
Right.
Versus
comprehensive.
Comprehensive. There you go. Thank you, Bob. Versus accident liability.
Right.
So your autonomous car gets in an accident and you go, hey, the sensor was bad, the algorithm didn't work, whatever it is, that liability is going to go to the automaker, which is going to have to insure those vehicles.
For that.
And then that's just going to get baked into the price of the car.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that if you look at some insurance companies now where they have this dongle that you will plug into the OBD2 port, yeah, and it monitors your car, so it sees whether you're speeding, it sees how many miles you've driven, and so on and so forth, and their argument being that because they're able to know exactly what's what, that your insurance rate will be lower. So the autonomous vehicle, they'll have all that information, right?
Sure.
So why would they not
know what's what, including where you're going, by the
right.
way?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, you spend X amount of time at in front of this place where there's a bar.
Right.
So we're going to raise your rate.
Or bad neighborhood for car theft, and you drive through there too often.
Well, but the biggest thing that insurance companies worry about is paying out on an injury or death.
Yeah, right.
By
yeah.
far.
Yeah.
And so that's the biggest question, is how are they going to handle that? And that depends on how robust and how much, whether autonomous cars reach their potential to reduce or eliminate fatalities.
Yeah.
Okay, we got another question here. Dan the Man wants to know, what do you think about Cadillac CT6 pricing? He says, I think it's going to further dwindle CTS sales and make XTS a fleet livery vehicle. Have we even gotten CT6 pricing?
They just announced it was like 55.
56, 50, something like that?
Yeah, 55,000 for the 2.0
right.
yeah. liter rear-wheel drive turbocharged.
So what do you guys think? Is that a good price?
I think it could cannibalize CTS a little bit. But if you look at the price steps up.
Impossible.
So I guess so. But if you look at the step up to the there's the 3 liter twin turbo, the high performance engine, yeah, and then there's a 3.6, the new 3.6,
yeah,
that's kind of the middle engine. The 3.6 gets you up well into the upper 60s, and then the twin turbo, I forget what the number is, but it's maybe in the low 70s,
yeah,
or something like that.
So that's not gonna.
And that's base, and you remember they're still doing options. They're not just doing packages, so.
I mean, you'd have to be into a pretty high zoot CTS-V to get 70s, right?
I was in charge of a four-season CTS-V Sport, which had everything but the premium package. That was 70,000 with the premium package. Right. So that was the car all out.
So, I mean, they've segmented it enough, I think. Now, XTS, that's another question. I mean,
that car should have gone away. Cadillac's becoming it's going to be a fleet vehicle here, and it's also they're saving it for the Chinese market. Mm-hmm. And
but the XTS is outselling the CTS, so why would you get rid of that?
Because it's a fleet vehicle. That's why it's outselling
right.
it.
But
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Well, maybe you wouldn't then.
Because you need numbers,
maybe
right?
You wouldn't then.
Right, so we got 18,000 XTS is being sold and 15,000.
On the other hand, the CT6, I'm not saying this is going to become a fleet vehicle, but if you look at the strategy, the CT6, all except for the 2-liter turbo 4, come with all-wheel drive, even though it's a rear drive platform. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what the fleet was in, say, New York livery, 10 years ago, they were all rear-wheel drive Lincoln Town cars. Mm-hmm. So if you could put those livery drivers into all-wheel drive cars that have, that are a little bit larger, that might be fine. I think they should do it with Buick. I've argued this, that they should do some version of the Avenir rear drive concept, all-wheel drive in that case, and make that their town car, basically.
Okay, so let's look at this a slightly different way. How many people will buy a $70,000 Cadillac?
People are already... Well, wait a minute. Trick question, because people are already buying $70,000 Cadillacs.
All right.
They're not paying...
Not Escalade Cadillacs.
Well, yeah. But they're buying a few, and they're probably paying far less than sticker for it.
Look, yeah. The thing that's got to worry Cadillac is the, as we've just talked about, ATS, CTS, terrific cars. Dead in the water. Dead. I mean, these things are dead in the water, right. Unless you start incentivizing them. And then you start hurting residuals, that hurts the brand, yada, yada. CT6, I'm not sure that I'm convinced it's really going to move the needle for them. I don't think Cadillac has a product problem. They got an image problem. They got a brand
problem.
So it's
all about the cachet of if you're going to put the money down.
I've got to believe that, Gary. You know, God, the ATS, CTS, and the V versions especially, yeah. Just knock out good cars, and they can't sell them very well.
But as any analyst will tell you, you need to do that well for several years before you get people back into them.
I know, but...
Yeah, but CTS, we're on the second generation of that car, right?
CTS is actually third generation.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
But they've also sized it up. It's also gone into a different size and price category. So...
Yeah. You know, look, we all said, you know, oh, it's going to take them 20 years to get this turned around. Well, they're what? Like 16 years into the 20. You know, this all started in 1999, really, the whole art and science and da-da-da. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here we are closing in on 20 years, and it isn't working.
So how are the guys feeling over in Dearborn at Lincoln, then? Is the Continental going to steal the thunder of the CT6, or is it going to be a completely different...
No, look, Lincoln's big problem now is that China is leveling out. The economy in China is leveling out. Mm-hmm. And they're entering just at that point. So companies like Buick and Audi are established there. They'll continue to do okay. But now Lincoln, you know, they're adding dealerships. They've got, I forgot, something like 20 now or fewer than 20. They're talking about 65, I think, by the end of next year. And, you know, so maybe they'll sell a few cars, but will they sell a lot of cars?
They need to sell. What will they do here, though?
They need to sell as many there as they're selling here. They need to sell more there than they're selling here, just like Buick did.
Right.
But at least their sales are going up.
Who sells?
Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
What are the latest? I didn't look at...
The total number may be going up because they're adding product. They just added the MKC.
So that
okay,
counts.
So... It does count, but...
All right, so for October, Lincoln brand is down 4.5%.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
For the year, they're up 7.5%.
Okay.
But man, you know, you look at this thing, I mean, just for October, MKZ down 4.1%, MKS down 12.6%, MKC down 9.8%. Here's the salvation. The MKX up 9.7%, and the real winner is the MKT up 34.9%.
Fleet car.
Yeah.
Delivery orders came in.
Right. Navigator down 24.7%.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So, I mean, it's just...
Again, Navigator was brand new a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And it's down 20. But
so it had
for the year,
but
it's up 35%.
Now it's where it should be. I'm saying last year it was.
All I'm gonna I've been watching those Navigator numbers, and they're bouncing up and down. I don't know what's going on there. So I wouldn't be too worried that they're down right now, only because the sales have been all over the map.
Right, but I mean, so the total year to date for the Navigator is 9,800 units.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know. It's not Escalade numbers.
Right.
Hey, I want to get to at least one phone call that we've got here. Carmen, I think we got one about Alfa Romeo, or let's bring in that first phoner.
Hey, guys. Jonathan out in Old Japan. Got a question for you. Can Sergio delay the Alfa brand any longer? How could he have run out of cash and needed to delay it another 6 months at this late stage? Was there supposed to be an Alfa Giulia diesel? And is that the reason of the delay? All I can say is it's a beautiful car. I just can't imagine at this late stage you'd have to delay it for any other reason. What's your take on it? Thanks.
Okay. Well, I don't think the Giulia is being delayed. I think
no. It is actually.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. It was supposed to launch late this year.
Yeah.
They've delayed it by about half a year. So even though the car was unveiled in Italy in June or July, whenever the anniversary was, and they're going to show it, I think, at the LA show, and they had it at the Frankfurt show, it is delayed. Okay. Launching it with a gas engine. I mean, they showed it as the high performance version, the kind of, I forget what they call it, but basically the M3 version of the Giulia. So that's a gas engine. But I think a few things, you know, a lot of the money being put into Alfa Romeo was dependent on the sale of Ferrari stock, and that turned out to be, I think, pretty successful in terms of the IPO. I have to wonder whether there may be quality issues. And then, of course, we mentioned Jeep before, and so that's... While they won't be making any money on that car for another 6 months, they're making money hand over fist on all these Jeeps.
Yeah.
No, that's how I read it, is that, look, we all knew from the get-go that Sergio's sales goal of 400,000 Alphas by 2018 was a crazy number.
It was 150,000 here.
And 150,000 in the U.S., yeah. Right. Now, and everybody went, no, that's never going to happen.
He's got to hurry up. They've sold 562 4C so far this year, so he's got...
That's the outgoing Giulietta, by the way. Yeah. That's not the Giulia.
Yeah, that's not the new one. But in any case, the other thing going on is that, you know... You guys heard the stories earlier this year. You know, suppliers are coming out and saying, hey, FCA is delaying programs. They're delaying the new Ram truck. Yeah. They're delaying the Grand Cherokee. Well, those are the crown jewels of the company. You know, how can you possibly delay the vehicles that are paying for all the bills?
The money makers.
And so Sergio's saying, oh, things are slowing down in China. I think there's more to it. I think other board members went, hey, wait a minute. You know, why don't we put the money in the product we know is going to produce instant profits, instant, instead of this hope and a dream that we can revive the Alfa brand.
Right.
And so I think they went, you know, we'll blame it on China and let's proceed a lot more slowly with Alfa and put those crank monies out into products where we know we can make money.
Crank out those renegades.
You got it.
Unless he's found a suitor.
Oh.
Yeah.
And the suitor is saying, well, we don't need Alfa Romeo so much as we need Jeep.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And we want to do a different Grand Cherokee. That's wild conjecture on my part.
Yeah.
But I think it's more of what you're saying, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, if they give you lemons, make lemonade. And, you know, I think he got a business plan for Alfa that people went, whoa, man, I just don't see this happening. Not in that time frame.
Right, right.
Well, how are the guys who put all their money into those dealerships here to sell Fiats feeling now? You know, that they were promised that they'd have all kinds of products to come, and so basically they got the 500, the 500L, and the 500X.
And the Spiata pretty soon.
Yeah.
And
the Spiata, right.
It's just
the
like...
The Spiata, yeah, I like that.
I mean, just think about that. I mean, these guys sunk in some serious money for those studios.
Yeah.
Not dealerships. Yeah. Studios.
That little car is going to...
They cannot be pleased.
The needle, though.
It's can't just, say anything about it.
It's incredible. Not. And so so what kind of faith are you going to have in this guy who then had that big meeting and told everybody that they would be the 150,000 units of Alfa sold here?
I think the original plan for Alfa Romeo made a lot more sense, and that was to sell BMW competitors at a lower price. Now, more recently, and this is even a couple of years ago already, Mark Ewan has said, hey, if BMW can get all that money for selling BMWs, why can't I for selling...
Okay, so here's my question. Then we were just talking about Cadillac.
Yeah.
So...
Well, exactly.
I mean, so exactly. isn't Cadillac selling competitors to BMW? And how's that working out for
them? Maybe what's happening at Cadillac is getting Sergio Mark Ewan to delay Alfa plans. But, you know... Nobody believed in it except for him, and even he, I think, he and his people conceded after that second five-year plan that if you look at the first five-year plan, it's more of a guideline than a plan, I think, to quote Bill Murray. You know, it's a guideline. It's what we'd like to do.
Look, you know, we shouldn't hold them to those plans. The company's made tremendous, tremendous progress, continues to make good progress. So if they don't hit exactly what they told us they were going to do, what's the big deal?
And Alfa, again, is a niche within that company and one that they've been trying to bring back. I did an Alfa trip in 2001 where they were introducing us to all the Alfa people because we're going to bring the brand back next year or in the next couple of years.
But counter that, though, Mark Ewan has said that, you know, his two crown jewels would be Jeep and Alfa Romeo. Those are his two premium brands that he can sell because of the brand name and the history and so on, and building upon that history. So maybe the question is, does he feel that they've succeeded with what they're doing with Alfa Romeo so far? Maybe that has something to do with the delay.
Yeah, and
again, getting back to the question of quality.
There's that whole Ram thing, too, you know. I mean, that's a pretty strong brand.
Ram's very strong, yeah.
They're doing fine.
They've done pretty good. Hey, look, we're getting down to the end here, and I want to get one more question in, because this just came in from the Philippines. This is from A.M. Guerrero, and he wants to know, has the VW diesel scandal affected other premium brands like Lamborghini or Bentley? He says, I know they don't use the same engines, but they're owned by the company that made those engines. Is this going to affect those? Does the public even see that sort of thing?
Just like the way the average American didn't know what was a GM brand or a Ford brand back when they had so many brands, probably most people on the street don't know or care about who owns Bentley or even Porsche, for that matter.
Right.
And the people who are buying those obviously are not slowing down on buying them.
It's
going to affect Porsche and Audi because of the V6 diesel issue that's just popped up.
But outside of those high-end Volkswagen brands, I think the bigger question is, how does it affect diesel in general?
Yeah.
I think we've probably all heard the rumblings. Is this the end of diesel in the U.S.?
Well, look, you know, we reported this in Autoline Daily today. Sales last month of the Chevy Cruze diesel just off like 50%.
Yeah.
The BMW 3 and 5 Series diesels off, I can't quote the numbers right off the top of my head, but, you know, in the 30% range.
I've had people within companies making diesels saying could be the end.
I agree. The one company I'd watched that has sold diesels here for a long, long time is Mercedes-Benz. Can they withstand
and good
that?
Good point, Todd, because the Mercedes E-Class diesel, and I'm only quoting passenger car sales now, sport utes, but the E-Class was the only one that bucked the trend. In fact, the numbers are not big, but diesel sales last month for Mercedes and the E-Class were up 20%. That's twice as much as the overall market.
And that's a model that has been for traditionally associated with a diesel and a strong diesel. So,
well, and one big difference is that Mercedes buyers will absorb that price. And in fact, they buy the diesel for it being a diesel.
Right.
Whereas Volkswagen, you know, you're selling the mileage and you're selling what they call clean diesel, rather cynically. And they apparently cut corners on the four-cylinder emissions in part because of the cost of cleaning those up. So
putting on an SCR system costs more dough, and so you want to do that. But so the bigger question is, how does this affect Seat and Skoda rather than Bentley and Lamborghini?
Right.
That's going to be their problem. If they crater with those two brands, they're in real trouble.
Yeah,
they are. Hey, look, we ought to wrap it up here. It's been great having the both of you. Bob Gritzinger from Ward's, Todd Lassa from Automobile Magazine. Great having you guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Joe.
Happy to have been able to participate. I think you need a campfire pit. I'll bring one next time.
Okay, you do that. We'll have you back.
Marshmallows, maybe some beer, right?
Yeah, there we
go. Fire Marshall would have some problems. But
Gary, you're going to be around next week?
I will be here next week.
Awesome. And you're going to come up with a great number, too, right?
That's right.
We want Dr. Data back here with those numbers. Real good. So thanks again, you guys, and want to thank everybody out there who is tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Chrysler.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.